she said. But I've been clean for 6 years. Wonderful, said Nate. One addict to another. Good for you. From that point on, the two talked about things as if they were alone. Nate had to pry, and he apologized for doing so. He asked about the $5 million, and with no small amount of humor, she told tales of good drugs and bad men. Unlike her brothers, Libigail had found stability. His name was Spike, the ex-biker who'd also been detoxed into submission. They lived in a small house in the suburbs of Baltimore. "What would you do if you got 1/6 of your father's estate?" Nate asked. "Buy lots of things," she said. "Same as you, same as anybody else. But I would be smart with the money this time. Real smart. What's the first thing you'd buy? The biggest Harley in the world for Spike? Then a nicer house. Not a mansion, though." Her eyes danced as she spent the money. Her deposition lasted less than 2 hours. Her sister, Mary Ross Phelan Jackman, followed her and likewise looked at Nate as if he had fangs. Of the 5 adult Phelan heirs, Mary Ross was the only one still married to her first spouse, though he had a prior wife. He was an orthopedist. She was dressed tastefully, with nice jewelry. The early questions revealed the standard prolonged college experience, but without arrests, addictions, or expulsions. She'd taken her money and lived in Tuscany for 3 years, then Nice for 2. At 28, she married the doctor, had 2 girls, one now 7, the other 5. It was unclear how much of the $5 million was left. The doctor handled their investments, so Nate figured they were practically broke. Wealthy, but heavily in debt. Josh's background on Mary Ross showed a massive home with imported cars stacked in the driveway, a condo in Florida, and an estimated income by the doc of $750,000 a year. He was paying $20,000 a month to a bank, his part of the residual damage from a failed partnership that tried to corner the car wash business in Northern Virginia. The doctor also had an apartment in Alexandria, where he kept a mistress. Mary Ross and her husband were rarely seen together. Nate decided not to discuss these matters. He was suddenly in a hurry, but careful not to show it. Ramble slouched into the room after the lunch break, his lawyer, Yancey, leading and pointing and fussing over him, obviously terrified now that his client was expected to carry on an intelligent conversation. The kid's hair was bright red now, and it sort of matched his zits. No portion of his face had gone unmutilated. Rings and studs littered and scarred his features. The collar of his black leather jacket was turned up James Dean style, so that it touched the earrings dangling from his lobes. After a few questions, it was obvious the kid was as stupid as he looked. Since he had not yet had the opportunity to squander his money, Nate left him alone. They established that he seldom went to school, lived alone in the basement, had never held a job for which he was paid, liked to play the guitar, and planned to be a serious rock star real soon. His new band was aptly called the Demon Monkeys, but he wasn't sure they would record under that name. He played no sports, had never seen the inside of a church, spoke to his mother as little as possible, and preferred to watch MTV whenever he was awake and not playing his music. It would take $1 billion in therapy to straighten out this poor kid, Nate thought. He finished with him in less than an hour. Gina was the last witness of the week. 4 days after her father's death, she and her husband Cody had signed a contract to purchase a home for $3.8 million. When Nate assaulted her with this information right after she was sworn, she began to stutter and stammer and look at her lawyer, Ms. Langhorne, who was equally surprised. Her client had not told her about the contract. "How did you plan to pay for the home?" Nate asked. The answer was obvious, but she couldn't confess it. "We have money," she said defensively, and this opened a door that Nate went barging through. "Let's talk about your money," he said with a smile. "You're 30 years old. 9 years ago you received $5 million, didn't you?"
"I did. How much of it is left?"
She struggled with the answer for a long time. The answer was not so simple. Cody had made a lot of money. They had invested some, spent a lot. It was all commingled, so you couldn't just look at their balance sheet and say there was X amount left from the $5 million. Nate gave her the rope, and she slowly hung herself. "How much money do you and your husband have today in your checking accounts?" he asked.
"I'd have to look."
"Guess, please. Just give me an estimate."
$60,000?
"How much real estate do you own?"
"Just our home."
"What is the value of your home?"
"I'd have to get it appraised."
"Guess, please, just a ballpark figure."
$300,000.
"And how much is your mortgage?"
$200,000.
"What is the approximate value of your portfolio?" She scribbled some notes and closed her eyes.
"Approximately $200,000.
"Any other significant assets?"
"Not really."
Nate did his own calculations. "So, in 9 years, your $5 million has been reduced to something in the range of $300,000 to $400,000, am I correct?"
"Surely not. I mean, it seems so low."
"So tell us again how you are going to pay for this new home."
"Through Cody's work."
"What about your dead father's estate? Ever think about that?"
"Maybe a little."
"Now you've been sued by the seller of the house, haven't you?"
"Yes, and we've countersued. There are a lot of issues."
She was shifty and dishonest, glib and quick with the half-truth. Nate thought she might be the most dangerous Phelan yet. They walked through Cody's ventures, and it was quickly apparent where the money had gone. He'd lost $1 million gambling on copper futures in 1992. He'd put $500,000 into snow-packed chickens and lost it all. An indoor worm farm in Georgia took $600,000 when a heat wave cooked the bait. They were two immature kids living a pampered life with someone else's money and dreaming of the big score. Near the end of her deposition, with Nate still feeding her all the rope she wanted, she testified with a straight face that her involvement in the will contest had nothing to do with money. She loved her father deeply, and he loved her, and if he'd had his right mind, he would have taken care of his children in his will. To give it all to a stranger was strong evidence of his illness. She was there fighting to protect the reputation of her father. It was a well-rehearsed little oration, and it convinced no one. Nate let it slide. It was 5 o'clock Friday afternoon, and he was tired of fighting. As he left the city and fought the heavy traffic on Interstate 95 to Baltimore, his thoughts were on the Phelan heirs. He had pried into their lives to the point of embarrassment. He felt sympathy for them, for the way they were raised, for the values they were never taught, for their hollow lives revolving around nothing but money. But Nate was convinced that Troy knew exactly what he was doing when he scrawled his testament. Serious money in the hands of his children would cause unmitigated chaos and untold misery. He left his fortune to Rachel, who had no interest in it. He excluded the others, whose lives were consumed by it. Nate was determined to uphold the validity of Troy's last testament. But he was also very much aware that the final distribution of the estate would not be determined by anyone in the Northern Hemisphere. It was late when he arrived in St. Michael's, and as he passed Trinity Church, he wanted to stop, go inside, kneel and pray, and ask God to forgive him for the sins of the week. Confession and a hot bath were needed after 5 days of depositions. Chapter 46. As a harried big city professional, Nate had never been introduced to the ritual of sitting. Phil, on the other hand, was an accomplished practitioner. When a parishioner was ill, he was expected to visit and sit with the family. If there was a death, he would sit with the widow. If a neighbor stopped by, regardless of the time, he and Laura would sit and chat. Sometimes they practiced the art by themselves, on the porch, in the swing, alone. Two elderly gentlemen in his congregation expected Phil to stop by once a week and simply sit for an hour while they dozed by the fire. Conversation was nice, but not required. It was perfectly fine to just sit and enjoy the stillness. But Nate caught on quickly. He sat with Phil on the front steps of the Stafford cottage, both men wearing heavy sweaters and gloves, and sipping hot cocoa Nate had prepared in the microwave. They gazed at the bay before them, at the harbor and the choppy waters beyond. Conversation crept up occasionally, but there was a lot of silence. Phil knew his friend had suffered a bad week. By now Nate had told him most of the details of the Phelan mess. Theirs was a confidential relationship. "I'm planning a road trip," Nate announced quietly. "Want to come?"
"To where?"
"I need to see my kids. I have two younger ones, Austin and Angela, in Salem, Oregon. I'll probably go there first. My older son is a grad student at Northwestern in Evanston, and I have a daughter in Pittsburgh. It'll be a nice little tour."
"How long?"
"There's no rush. A couple of weeks. I'm driving."
"When did you see them last?"
"It's been over a year since I've seen Daniel and Caitlin, the two from my first marriage. I took the two younger ones to an Orioles game last July. I got drunk and didn't remember driving back to Arlington."
"Do you miss them?"
"Sure, I guess. Truth is, I never spent much time with them. I know so little about them."
"You were working hard."
"I was, and I was drinking even harder. I was never at home. On those rare occasions when I could take off, I would go to Vegas with the boys, or golfing, or deep-sea fishing in the Bahamas. I never took the kids."
"You can't change that."
"No, I can't. Why don't you come with me? We could talk for hours."
"Thanks, but I can't leave. I've finally built some momentum in the basement. I'd hate to lose it."
Nate had seen the basement earlier in the day. There was evidence of momentum. Phil's only child was a 20-something drifter who'd flunked out of college and fled to the West Coast. Laura had let it slip that they had no idea where the kid was. He hadn't called home in over a year.
"Do you expect the trip to be successful?"
Phil asked. "I'm not sure what to expect. I want to hug my kids and apologize for being such a lousy father. But I'm not sure how that's supposed to help them now."
"I wouldn't do that. They know you've been a lousy father. Flogging yourself won't help. But it's important to be there, to take the first step in building new relationships. I was such a miserable failure for my kids."
"You can't beat yourself up, Nate. You're allowed to forget the past. God certainly has. Paul murdered Christians before he became one, and he didn't flail himself for what he'd been before. Everything is forgiven. Show your kids what you are now." A small fishing boat backed away from the harbor and turned into the bay. It was the only blip on their screen, and they watched with rapt attention. Nate thought of Jevy and Welly back on the river now, guiding a Shawanah loaded with produce and wares, the steady knock of the diesel pushing them deep into the Pantanal. Jevy would have the wheel, Welly would be strumming his guitar. All the world was at peace. Later, long after Phil had gone home, Nate huddled by the fire and began another letter to Rachel. It was his third. He dated it Saturday, February 22nd. "Dear Rachel," he began, "I have just spent a very unpleasant week with your brothers and sisters." He talked about them, beginning with Troy Jr. and ending 3 pages later with Ramble. He was honest about their shortcomings and the damage they would inflict on themselves and others if they got the money. And he was sympathetic, too. He was sending a check to World Tribes for $5,000 for a boat, a motor, and medical supplies. There was plenty more if she needed. The interest on her fortune was about $2 million a day, he informed her, so a lot of good things could be done with the money. Hark Geddes and his conspirators at law blundered badly when they terminated the services of Doctors Flo, Zadel, and Thetian. The lawyers had rebuked the doctors and offended them, and caused irreparable damage. The new batch of psychiatrists had the benefit of Sneed's newly fabricated testimony upon which to create their opinions. Flo, Zadel, and Thetian did not. When Nate deposed them Monday, he followed the same script with all three. He began with Zadel and showed him the video of the examination of Mr. Phelan. He asked him if he had any reason to alter his opinions. Zadel, as expected, said no. The video happened before the suicide. The 8-page affidavit was prepared just hours afterward, at the insistence of Hark and the other Phelan lawyers. Zadel was asked by Nate to read the affidavit to the court reporter. "Do you have any reason to change any of the opinions set out in that affidavit?" Nate asked. "I do not," Zadel said, looking at Hark. "Today is February 24th, 2 months after your examination of Mr. Phelan. Is it your opinion today that he had sufficient mental capacity to execute a valid will?" "It is," Zadel answered, smiling at Hark. Flo and Thetian smiled too, each genuinely happy to turn the screws on the lawyers who'd hired them and fired them. Nate showed each of them the video, asked them the same questions, and received the same answers. Each read his affidavit into the record. They adjourned at 4 Monday afternoon. At 8:30 sharp Tuesday morning, Sneed was escorted into the room and placed in the chair of honor. He wore a dark suit with a bow tie, which gave him a brainy aura that was undeserved. The lawyers had carefully selected his wardrobe. They'd been molding and programming Sneed for weeks, and the poor man doubted if he could utter a spontaneous or honest word. Every syllable had to be right. He had to project an air of confidence, yet avoid even the slightest hint of arrogance. He and he alone defined reality, and it was crucial that his stories were believable. Josh had known Sneed for many years. He was a servant whom Mr. Phelan often talked of getting rid of. Of the 11 wills Josh had prepared for Troy Phelan, only one mentioned the name of Malcolm Sneed. A gift of $1 million had been designated for him, a gift revoked months later with yet another will. Mr. Phelan had removed Sneed's name precisely because Sneed had inquired as to how much he might expect to receive. Sneed had been too preoccupied with the money to suit his master. His name on the witness list for the contestants meant only one thing, money. He was being paid to testify, and Josh knew it. 2 weeks of simple surveillance had discovered a new Range Rover, a newly leased condo in a building where the prices started at $1,800 a month, and a trip to Rome first class. Sneed faced the video camera and was somewhat comfortable. He felt as though he'd been looking at one for a year. He'd spent all of Saturday and half of Sunday in Hark's office getting himself grilled again. He'd watched the videos of himself for hours. He'd written dozens of pages of fiction on the final days of Troy Phelan. He'd rehearsed with Nicolette the Bimbo. Sneed was ready. The lawyers had anticipated questions about the money. If asked whether he was being paid to testify, Sneed was trained to lie. It was that simple. There was no way around it. Sneed had to lie about the $500,000 already in hand, and he had to lie about the promise of $4.5 million upon settlement or other favorable outcome. He had to lie about the existence of the contract between himself and the lawyers. Since he was lying about Mr. Phelan, he could certainly lie about the money. Nate introduced himself and then asked quite loudly, "Mr. Sneed, how much are you being paid to testify in this case?" Sneed's lawyers thought the question would be, "Are you being paid?" not "How much?" Sneed's rehearsed answer was a simple, "No, I certainly am not." But to the question still ringing around the room, he had no quick response. Hesitation sank him. He seemed to gasp as he looked wildly at Hark, whose spine had become rigid and his stare frozen like a deer's. Sneed had been warned that Mr. O'Reilly had done his homework and seemed to know everything before he asked the questions. In the long, painful seconds that followed, Mr. O'Reilly frowned at him, cocked his head sideways, and lifted some papers. "Come on, Mr. Sneed, I know you're being paid. How much?" Sneed cracked his knuckles hard enough to break them. Beads of sweat popped out in the creases of his forehead.
"Well, I'm not..."
"Come on, Mr. Sneed. Did you or did you not purchase a new Range Rover last month?"
"Well, yes, as a matter of..."
"And you leased a two-bedroom condo at Palm Court?"
"Yes, I did."
"And you just returned from 10 days in Rome, didn't you?"
"I did."
He knew everything. The Phelan lawyers shrank in their seats, each cowering lower, ducking their heads so the ricocheting bullets wouldn't strike them. "So how much are you being paid?" Nate asked angrily. "Keep in mind you're under oath."
$500,000, Sneed blurted out.
Nate stared at him in disbelief, his jaw dropping slowly. Even the court reporter froze. A couple of the Phelan lawyers managed to exhale slightly. As horrible as the moment was, it could certainly have been bloodier. What if Sneed had panicked even more and confessed to the entire $5 million? But it was a very small comfort. At the moment, the news that they had paid a witness $500,000 seemed fatal to their cause. Nate shuffled papers as if he needed some document. The words still echoed through all the ears in the room. "I take it you have already received this money?" Nate asked. Unsure whether he was supposed to lie or go straight, Sneed simply said,
"Yes."
On a hunch, Nate asked, $500,000 now. How much later?" Anxious to begin the lying, Sneed answered,
"Nothing."
It was a casual denial, one that appeared believable. The other two Phelan lawyers were able to breathe. "Are you sure about that?" Nate asked. He was fishing. He could ask Sneed if he'd been convicted of grave robbing if he wanted to. It was a game of high-stakes chicken, and Sneed held firm.
"Of course I'm sure," he said, with enough indignance to seem plausible.
"Who paid you this money?"
"The lawyers for the Phelan heirs."
"Who signed the check?"
"It came from a bank, certified."
"Did you insist they pay you for your testimony?"
"I guess you could say that."
"Did you go to them, or did they come to you?"
"I went to them."
"Why did you go to them?" Finally, they seemed to be approaching familiar territory. There was a general relaxing on the Phelan side of the table. The lawyers began to scribble notes. Sneed crossed his legs under the table and frowned intelligently at the camera.
"Because I was with Mr. Phelan before he died, and I knew the poor man was out of his mind."
"How long had he been out of his mind?"
"All day."
"When he woke up, he was crazy?"
"When I fed him breakfast, he did not know my name."
"What did he call you?"
"Nothing. He just grunted at me."
Nate leaned on his elbows and ignored the paperwork around him. This was a jousting match, and he actually enjoyed it. He knew where he was going, but poor Sneed did not. "Did you see him jump?"
"Yes."
"And fall?"
"Yes."
"And hit the ground?"
"Yes."
"Were you standing near him when he was examined by the three psychiatrists?"
"Yes."
"And this was about 2:30 in the afternoon, right?"
"Yes, as I recall."
"And he'd been crazy all day, right?"
"I'm afraid so, yes."
"How long did you work for Mr. Phelan?"
30 years.
"And you knew everything about him, right?"
"As much as one person can know about another."
"So you knew his lawyer, Mr. Stafford?"
"Yes, I'd met him many times."
"Did Mr. Phelan trust Mr. Stafford?"
"I suppose."
"I thought you knew everything."
"I'm sure he trusted Mr. Stafford."
"Was Mr. Stafford sitting by his side during the mental examination?"
"He was."
"What was Mr. Phelan's mental state during the exam, in your opinion?"
"He was unsound, uncertain of where he was and what he was doing."
"You're sure about this?"
"I am."
"Who did you tell?"
"It wasn't my job to tell."
"Why not?"
I would have been fired. Part of my job was to keep my mouth shut. It's called discretion.
You knew Mr. Phelan was going to sign a will dividing his vast fortune. At the same time, he was of unsound mind, yet you didn't tell his lawyer, a man he trusted.
It wasn't my job.
Mr. Phelan would have fired you?
Immediately.
Then what about after he jumped?
Who did you tell then? No one.
Why not? Sneed took a breath and recrossed his legs. He was rallying nicely, he thought.
It was a matter of privacy, he said gravely. I considered my relationship with Mr. Phelan to be confidential.
Until now. Until they offered you $500,000, right? Sneed could think of no quick reply, and Nate didn't offer much of a chance. You're selling not only your testimony, but also your confidential relationship with Mr. Phelan, right, Mr. Sneed?
I'm trying to undo an injustice.
How noble. Would you be undoing it if they weren't paying you?
Sneed managed to utter a shaky,
yes,
and Nate erupted in laughter. He laughed loud and long, and did so while looking at the solemn and partially hidden faces of the Phelan lawyers. He laughed directly at Sneed. He stood and walked along his end of the table, chuckling to himself. What a trial, he said, then sat down again. He glanced at some notes, then continued.
Mr. Phelan died on December the 9th. His will was read on December the 27th. During the interval, did you tell anyone that he was of unsound mind when he signed his will?
No.
Of course not. You waited until after the will was read, then, realizing you had been cut out, decided to go to the lawyers and strike a deal, didn't you, Mr. Sneed? The witness answered no, but Nate ignored him. Was Mr. Phelan mentally ill?
I'm not an expert in that field.
You said he was out of his mind. Was this a permanent condition?
It came and went.
How long had it been coming and going?
For years.
How many years?
10, maybe. It's just a guess.
In the last 14 years of his life, Mr. Phelan executed 11 wills, one of which left you $1,000,000. Did you ever think of telling anyone then that he was of unsound mind?
It wasn't my job to tell.
Did he ever see a psychiatrist?
Not to my knowledge.
Did he ever see any mental health professional?
Not to my knowledge.
Did you ever suggest to him that he seek professional help?
It wasn't my job to suggest such things.
If you'd found him lying on the floor having a seizure, would you have suggested to someone that perhaps he needed help?
Of course I would have.
If you'd found him coughing blood, would you have told someone?
Yes.
Nate had a memo 2 inches thick with summaries of Mr. Phelan's holdings. He flipped to a page at random and asked Sneed if he knew anything about Zion drilling. Sneed struggled mightily to remember, but his mind had been so overloaded with new data that it failed him. Dell Star Communications? Again, Sneed grimaced, but could not make the connection. The fifth company Nate mentioned rang a bell. Sneed proudly informed the lawyer that he knew the company. Mr. Phelan had owned it for quite some time. Nate had questions about sales, products, holdings, earnings, an endless list of financial statistics. Sneed answered nothing right. How much did you know about Mr. Phelan's holdings? Nate asked repeatedly. Then he asked questions about the structure of the Phelan Group. Sneed had memorized the basics, but the smaller details escaped him. He could name no mid-level manager. He did not know the name of the company's accountants. Nate hammered him relentlessly about the things he didn't know. Late in the afternoon, with Sneed weary and punch drunk, Nate, in the midst of the millionth question about financials, asked with no warning, "Did you sign a contract with the lawyers when you took the $500,000?" A simple no would have sufficed, but Sneed was caught off guard. He hesitated, looked at Hark, then looked at Nate, who was again shuffling through papers as if he had a copy of the contract. Sneed hadn't lied in 2 hours and wasn't quick.
Of course not, he stuttered,
and convinced no one. Nate saw the untruth and let it go. There were other ways to obtain a copy of the contract. The Phelan lawyers met in a dark bar to lick their wounds. Sneed's dismal performance seemed even worse after two rounds of stiff drinks. He could be propped up some for trial, but the fact that he'd been paid so much would forever taint his testimony. How did O'Reilly know? He was so certain Sneed had been paid. "It was grit," Hark said. "Grit," they all repeated to themselves. Surely grit hadn't gone to the other side. "That's what you get for stealing his client," Wally Bright said after a long silence. "Shut up," Ms. Langhorne said. Hark was too tired to fight. He finished his drink and ordered another. In the flood of testimony, the other Phelan lawyers had forgotten about Rachel. There was still no official record of her in the court file. Chapter 47. The deposition of Nicolette, the secretary, lasted 8 minutes. She gave her name, address, and brief employment history, and the Phelan lawyers on the other side settled into their chairs to await the details of her sexual escapades with Mr. Phelan. She was 23, with few qualifications beyond a slender body, nice chest, and a pretty face with sandy blonde hair. They couldn't wait to hear her spend a few hours talking about sex. Getting right to the point, Nate asked, "Did you ever have sex with Mr. Phelan?" She tried to appear embarrassed by the question, but said yes anyway. "How many times?"
"I didn't count them."
"For how long?"
"Usually 10 minutes."
"No, I mean for how long a period of time? Starting in what month and ending when?"
"Oh, I only worked there 5 months."
"Roughly 20 weeks. On the average, how many times each week did you have sex with Mr. Phelan?"
2 times, I guess."
"So about 40 times.
"I guess. That sounds like a lot, doesn't it?"
"Not to me. Did Mr. Phelan take his clothes off when you guys did it?"
"Sure. We both did."
"So he was completely naked?"
"Yes."
"Did he have any visible birthmarks on his body?" When witnesses concoct lies, they often miss the obvious. So do their lawyers. They become so consumed with their fiction that they overlook a fact or two. Hark and the guys had access to the Phelan wives, Lillian, Janie, Tyra, any one of whom could have told them that Troy had a round purple birthmark the size of a silver dollar at the very top of his right leg, near the hip, just below the waist.
"Not that I recall," Nicolette answered.
The answer surprised Nate, and then it didn't. He could have easily believed that Troy was doing his secretary, something he'd done for decades, and he could just as easily have believed Nicolette was lying. "No visible birthmarks?" Nate asked again.
"None."
The Phelan lawyers were stricken with fear. Could another star witness be melting before their eyes? "No further questions," Nate said, and left the room to refill his coffee. Nicolette looked at the lawyers. They were staring at the table, wondering exactly where the birthmark was. After she left, Nate slid an autopsy photo across the table to his bewildered enemies. He didn't say a word, didn't need to. Old Troy was on the slab, nothing but withered and battered flesh, with the birthmark staring out from the photo. They spent the rest of Wednesday and all day Thursday with the 4 new psychiatrists who'd been hired to say that the 3 old ones really didn't know what they were doing. Their testimony was predictable and repetitive. People with sound minds do not jump out of windows. As a group, they were less distinguished than Flo, Zadel, and Thetian. A couple were retired and picked up a few retainers here and there as professional testifiers. One taught at a crowded community college. One eked out a living in a small office in the suburbs. But they weren't paid to be impressive. Rather, their purpose was simply to muddy the water. Troy Phelan was known to be erratic and eccentric. 4 experts said he didn't have the mental capacity to execute a will. 3 said he did. Keep the issues dense and tangled and hope those supporting the will would one day grow weary and settle. If not, it would be up to a jury of laymen to sift through the medical jargon and make sense of the conflicting opinions. The new experts were paid well to stick to their convictions, and Nate didn't try to change them. He had deposed enough doctors to know not to argue medicine with them. Instead, he dwelt on their credentials and experience. He made them watch the video and criticize the first three psychiatrists. When they adjourned Thursday afternoon, 15 depositions had been completed. Another round was scheduled for late March. Wycliffe was planning a trial for the middle of July. The same witnesses would testify again, but in open court, with spectators watching and jurors weighing every word. Nate fled the city. He went west, through Virginia, then south, through the Shenandoah Valley. His mind was numb from 9 days of hardball probing into the intimate lives of others. At some undefined point in his life, pushed by his work and his addictions, he had lost his decency and shame. He had learned to lie, cheat, deceive, hide, badger, and attack innocent witnesses without the slightest twinge of guilt. But in the quiet of his car and the darkness of the night, Nate was ashamed. He had pity for the failing children. He felt sorry for Sneed, a sad little man just trying to survive. He wished he hadn't attacked the new experts with such vigor. His shame was back, and Nate was pleased. He was proud of himself for feeling so ashamed. He was human after all. At midnight, he stopped at a cheap motel near Knoxville. There was heavy snow in the Midwest, in Kansas and Iowa. Lying in bed with his atlas, he mapped a trail through the Southwest. He slept the second night in Shawnee, Oklahoma, the third in Kingman, Arizona, the fourth in Redding, California. The kids from his second marriage were Austin and Angela, 12 and 11, respectively, 7th and 6th grades. He'd last seen them in July, 3 weeks before the last crash, when he took them to an Orioles game. The pleasant outing later turned into another ugly scene. Nate had drunk 6 beers at the game, the kids counted because their mother told them to, and he drove the 2 hours from Baltimore to Arlington under the influence. At the time, they were moving to Oregon with their mother, Christy, and her second husband, Theo. The game was to be Nate's last visit with them for some time, and instead of dwelling on goodbyes, Nate got plastered. He fought with his ex-wife in the driveway while the children watched, all too familiar with the scene. Theo had threatened him with a broom handle. Nate woke up in his car, parked in the handicapped zone of a McDonald's, an empty six-pack on the seat. When they met 14 years earlier, Christy was the headmistress of a private school in Potomac. She was on a jury. Nate was one of the lawyers. She wore a short black skirt on the second day of the trial, and the litigation practically stopped. Their first date was a week later. For 3 years, Nate stayed clean, long enough to get remarried and have the 2 kids. When the dam started cracking, Christy was scared and wanted to run. When it burst, she fled with the children and didn't return for a year. The marriage endured 10 chaotic years. She was working at a school in Salem. Theo was with a small law firm there. Nate had always believed that he ran them out of Washington. He couldn't blame them for fleeing to the other coast. He called the school from his car near Medford, 4 hours away, and was put on hold for 5 minutes. Time, he was certain, for her to lock her door and collect her thoughts. "Hello," she finally said. "Christy, it's me, Nate," he said, feeling silly, identifying his voice to a woman he'd lived with for 10 years. "Where are you?" she asked, as if an attack were imminent. "Near Medford."
"In Oregon?"
"Yes. I'd like to see the kids."
"Well, when?"
"Tonight. Tomorrow, I'm in no hurry. I've been on the road for a few days, just seeing the country. I have no itinerary."
"Well, sure, Nate, I guess we can work something out.
But the kids are very busy, you know, school, ballet, soccer.
How are they?
They're doing very well, thanks for asking.
And you? How's life treating you?
I'm fine. We love Oregon.
I'm doing well, too, thanks for asking. I'm clean and sober, Christy.
Really?
I finally kicked the booze and drugs for good. Looks like I'll be leaving the practice of law, but I'm doing really well.
She'd heard it before.
That's good, Nate.
Her words were cautious. She was planning two sentences in advance. They agreed to have dinner the following night, enough time for her to prepare the kids and fix up the house and allow Theo to decide what his role should be. Enough time to rehearse and plan exits.
I won't get in the way, Nate promised before hanging up.
Theo decided to work late and skip the reunion. Nate hugged Angela tightly. Austin just shook hands. The one thing he vowed not to do was gush about how much they'd grown. Christy loitered in her bedroom for an hour as the father was reintroduced to his children. Nor would he bury them with apologies about things he couldn't change. They sat on the floor of the den and talked about school and ballet and soccer. Salem was a pretty town, much smaller than D.C., and the kids had adjusted well, with lots of friends, a good school, nice teachers. Dinner was spaghetti and salad, and it lasted for 1 hour. Nate told tales from the jungles of Brazil as he took them on his journey to find the missing client. Evidently, Christy had not seen the right newspapers. She knew nothing of the Phelan matter. At 7 sharp, he said he had to go. They had homework, and school came early.
"I have a soccer game tomorrow, Dad," Austin said, and Nate's heart almost stopped.
He couldn't remember the last time he'd been called Dad.
"It's at the school," Angela said. "Could you come?"
The little ex-family shared an awkward moment as each of them glanced at the other. Nate had no idea what to say. Christy settled the issue by saying, "I'll be there. We could talk."
"Of course I'll be there," he said.
The children hugged him as he left. Driving away, Nate suspected Christy wanted to see him 2 days in a row to examine his eyes. She knew the signs. Nate stayed in Salem for 3 days. He watched the soccer game and was overcome with pride in his son. He got himself invited back to dinner, but agreed to come only if Theo would join them. He had lunch with Angela and her friends at school. After 3 days, it was time to leave. The kids needed their normal routines back without the complications Nate brought. Christy was tired of pretending nothing had ever happened between them. And Nate was getting attached to his children. He promised to call and email and see them soon. He left Salem with a broken heart. How low could a man sink to lose such a wonderful family? He remembered almost nothing of his kids when they were smaller. No school plays, Halloween costumes, Christmas mornings, trips to the mall. Now they were practically grown, and another man was raising them. He turned east and drifted with the traffic. While Nate was meandering through Montana, thinking of Rachel, Hark Geddes filed a motion to dismiss her answer to the will contest. His reasons were clear and obvious, and he supported his attack with a 20-page brief he'd worked on for a month. It was March 7th, almost 3 months after the death of Mr. Phelan, not quite 2 months after the entry of Nate O'Reilly into the matter, nearly 3 weeks into discovery, 4 months before the trial, and the court still did not have jurisdiction over Rachel Lane. But for the allegations of her attorney, there'd been no sign of her. No document in the official court file had her signature on it. Hark referred to her as the Phantom Party. He and the other contestants were litigating against a shadow. The woman stood to inherit $11 billion. The least she could do was sign a waiver and follow the law. If she'd gone to the trouble to hire a lawyer, she could certainly subject herself to the jurisdiction of the court. The passage of time was benefiting the heirs greatly, though it was hard for them to be patient while dreaming of such wealth. Each week that passed with no word from Rachel was further proof that she had no interest in the proceedings. At the Friday morning meetings, the Phelan lawyers reviewed discovery, talked about their clients, and plotted trial strategy. But they spent most of their time speculating why Rachel had not made an official appearance. They were enthralled with the ridiculous notion that she might not want the money. It was absurd, yet it somehow managed to surface every Friday morning. The weeks were turning into months. The lottery winner was not claiming her prize. There was another significant reason for putting pressure on the defenders of Troy's testament. His name was Sneed. Hark, Yancey, Bright, and Langhorne had watched their star witness's deposition until it was memorized, and they were not confident of his ability to sway jurors. Nate O'Reilly had made a fool out of him, and that was only in a deposition. Imagine how sharp the daggers would be at trial, in front of a jury made up primarily of middle-class folks struggling to pay their monthly bills. Sneed pocketed $500,000 to tell his story. It would be a hard sell. The problem with Sneed was obvious. He was lying, and liars eventually get caught in court. After Sneed stumbled so badly in the deposition, the lawyers were terrified of presenting him to a jury. Another lie or two exposed to the world, and their case was down the toilet. The birthmark had rendered Nicolette completely useless as a witness. Their own clients were not particularly sympathetic. With the exception of Ramble, who was the scariest of all, each had been handed $5 million with which to get a start. None of the jurors would earn that much in a lifetime. Troy's children could whine about being raised by an absent father, but half the jurors would be from broken homes. The Battle of the Shrinks would be hard to call, but it was the segment of the trial that worried them the most. Nate O'Reilly had been shredding doctors in courtrooms for more than 20 years. Therefore, substitutes could not withstand his brutal cross-examinations. To avoid a trial, they had to settle. To settle, they had to find a weakness. Rachel Lane's apparent lack of interest was more than sufficient, and certainly their best shot. Josh reviewed the motion to dismiss with admiration. He loved the legal maneuvering, the ploys and tactics, and when someone, even an opponent, got it right, he silently applauded. Everything about Hark's move was perfect, the timing, the rationale, the superbly argued brief. The contestants had a weak case, but their problems were small compared to Nate's. Nate had no client. He and Josh had managed to keep this quiet for 2 months, but the ruse had run its course. Chapter 48. Daniel, his oldest child, insisted on meeting him in a pub. Nate found the place after dark, 2 blocks off the campus, on a street lined with bars and clubs. The music, the flashing beer signs, the co-eds yelling across the street, it was all too familiar. It was Georgetown just a few months ago, and none of it appealed to him. A year earlier he would have been yelling back, chasing them from one bar to the other, believing he was still 20 and able to go all night. Daniel was waiting in a cramped booth along with a girl. Both were smoking. Each had 2 long-neck bottles sitting on the table in front of them. Father and son shook hands because anything more affectionate would make the son feel uncomfortable. "This is Steph," Daniel said, introducing the girl. "She's a model," he added quickly, proving to his old man that he was chasing a high caliber of woman. For some reason, Nate had hoped they could spend a few hours alone. It was not going to happen. The first thing he noticed about Steph was her gray lipstick, applied heavily to the thick and pouty lips, lips that scarcely cracked when she gave him the obligatory half-smile. She was certainly plain and gaunt enough to be a model. Her arms were as skinny as broom handles. Though Nate couldn't see them, he knew her bony legs ran to her armpits, and without a doubt there were at least 2 tattoos burned into the flesh around her ankles. Nate disliked her immediately, and got the impression the feeling was mutual. No telling what Daniel had told her. Daniel had finished college at Grinnell a year earlier, then spent the summer in India. Nate had not seen him in 13 months. He had not gone to his commencement, had not sent a card or a gift, had not bothered to call with congratulations. There was enough tension at the table without the mannequin puffing smoke and looking at Nate with a completely blank stare. "You want a beer?" Daniel asked when a waiter got close. It was a cruel question, a quick little shot designed to inflict pain. "No, just water," Nate said. Daniel yelled at the waiter, then said, "Still on the wagon, huh?" "Always," Nate said with a smile, trying to deflect the arrows. "Have you fallen off since last summer?" "No. Let's talk about something else." "Dan tells me you've been through rehab," Steph said, smoke drifting from her nostrils. Nate was surprised she was able to start and finish a sentence. Her words were slow, her voice as hollow as her eye sockets. "I have, several times. What else has he told you?" "I've done rehab," she said, "but only once." She seemed proud of her accomplishment, yet saddened by her lack of experience. The two beer bottles in front of her were empty. "That's nice," Nate said, dismissing her. He couldn't pretend to like her, and in a month or two she'd have another serious love. "How's school?" he asked Daniel.
"What school?"
"Grad school."
"I dropped out."
His words were edgy and strained. There was pressure behind them. Nate was involved in the dropping out. He just wasn't exactly sure how and why. His water arrived. "Have you guys eaten?" he asked. Steph avoided food, and Daniel wasn't hungry. Nate was starving, but didn't want to eat alone. He glanced around the pub. Pot was being smoked somewhere in another corner. It was a rowdy little dump, the kind of place he'd loved in a not-too-distant life. Daniel lit another cigarette, a Camel with no filter, the worst cancer sticks on the market, and he blasted a cloud of thick smoke at the cheap beer chandelier hanging above them. He was angry and tense. The girl was there for two reasons. She would prevent harsh words and maybe a fight. Nate suspected his son was broke, that he wanted to lash out at his father for his lack of support, but that he was afraid to do so because the old man was fragile and had been prone to crack and go off the deep end. Steph would throttle his anger and his language. The second reason was to make the meeting as brief as possible. It took about 15 minutes to figure this out. "How's your mother?" he asked. Daniel attempted to smile.
"She's fine. I saw her at Christmas. You were gone."
"I was in Brazil." A co-ed in tight jeans walked by. Steph inspected her from top to bottom, her eyes finally showing some life. The girl was even skinnier than Steph. How did emaciation become so cool?
"What's in Brazil?" Daniel asked.
"A client?" Nate was tired of the stories from his adventure.
"Mom says you're in some kind of trouble with the IRS.
"I'm sure that pleases your mother."
"I guess. She didn't seem bothered by it. You going to jail?"
"No, could we talk about something else?"
"That's the problem, Dad. There is nothing else. Nothing but the past, and we can't go there."
Steph, the referee, rolled her eyes at Daniel as if to say that's enough. "Why did you drop out of school?" Nate asked, anxious to get it over with.
"Several reasons. It got boring." "He ran out of money," Steph said helpfully. She gave Nate her best blank look.
"Is that true?" Nate asked.
"That's one reason."
Nate's first instinct was to pull out his checkbook and solve the kid's problems. That's what he'd always done. Parenting for him had been one long shopping trip. If you can't be there, send money. But Daniel was now 23, a college grad, hanging around with the likes of Ms. Bulimia over there, and it was time for him to sink or swim on his own. And the checkbook wasn't what it used to be. "It's good for you," Nate said. "Work for a while. It'll make you appreciate school." Steph disagreed. She had two friends who'd dropped out and pretty much fallen off the face of the earth. As she prattled on, Daniel withdrew to his corner of the booth. He drained his third bottle. Nate had all sorts of lectures about alcohol, but he knew how funny they'd sound. After four beers, Steph was bombed and Nate had nothing else to say. He scribbled his phone number in St. Michael's on a napkin and gave it to Daniel. "This is where I'll be for the next couple of months. Call me if you need me." "See ya, Pop," Daniel said. "Take care." Nate stepped into the frigid air and walked toward Lake Michigan. 2 days later, he was in Pittsburgh for his third and final reunion, one that did not occur. He'd spoken twice to Caitlin, his daughter from marriage number one, and the details were clear. She was to meet him for dinner at 7:30 p.m. in front of the restaurant in the lobby of his hotel. Her apartment was 20 minutes away. She paged him at 8:30 with the news that a friend had been involved in an auto accident and that she was at the hospital where things looked bad. Nate suggested they have lunch the following day. Caitlin said that wouldn't work because the friend had a head injury, was on life support, and she planned to stay with her there until she was stable. With his daughter in full retreat, Nate asked where the hospital was located. At first she didn't know, then she wasn't sure, then upon further thought a visit was not a good idea because she couldn't leave the bedside. He ate in his room, at a small table next to the window, with a view of downtown. He picked at his food and thought of all the possible reasons his daughter didn't want to see him. A ring in her nose, a tattoo on her forehead, had she joined a cult and shaved her head? Had she gained 100 pounds or lost 50? Was she pregnant? He tried to blame her so he wouldn't be forced to face the obvious. Did she hate him that much? In the loneliness of the hotel room, in a city where he knew no one, it was easy to pity himself, to suffer once again through the mistakes of his past. He grabbed the phone and got busy. He called Father Phil to check on things in St. Michael's. Phil had been bothered by the flu, and since it was chilly in the church basement, Laura wouldn't let him work there. How wonderful, thought Nate. Though many uncertainties lay in his path, the one constant, at least for the near future, would be the promise of steady work in the basement of Trinity Church. He called Sergio for their weekly pep session. The demons were well in hand, and he felt surprisingly under control. His hotel room had a minibar, and he had not been near it. He called Salem, and had a pleasant chat with Angela and Austin. Odd how the younger kids wanted to talk, while the older ones did not. He called Josh, who was in his basement office, thinking about the Phelan mess. "You need to come home, Nate," he said. "I have a plan." Chapter 49 Nate wasn't invited to the first round of peace talks. There were a couple of reasons for his absence. First, Josh arranged the summit, so it was therefore held on his turf. Nate had thus far avoided his old office and wanted this to continue. Second, the Phelan lawyers viewed Josh and Nate as allies, and rightfully so. Josh wanted the role of peacemaker, the intermediary. To gain trust from one side, he had to ignore the other, if only for a short while. His plan was to meet with Hark et al., then with Nate, then back and forth for a few days, if necessary, until a deal was struck. After a lengthy session of pleasantries and chit-chat, Josh asked for their attention. They had lots of territory to cover. The Phelan lawyers were anxious to get started. A settlement can happen in seconds. During a recess in a heated trial, when a witness stumbles, or when a new CEO wants to start fresh and unload nagging litigation. And a settlement can take months as the lawsuit inches toward a trial date. As a whole, the Phelan lawyers dreamed of a quickie, and the meeting in Josh's suite was the first step. They truly believed they were about to become millionaires. Josh began by diplomatically offering his opinion that their case was rather flimsy. He knew nothing about his client's plans to whip out a holographic will and create chaos, but it was a valid will nonetheless. He had spent 2 hours with Mr. Phelan the previous day finishing the other new will, and he was prepared to testify that he knew exactly what he was doing. He would also testify, if necessary, that Sneed was nowhere in the picture when they met. The three psychiatrists who examined Mr. Phelan had been carefully chosen by Phelan's children and ex-wives and their lawyers, and had impeccable credentials. The four now on retainer were flaky. Their resumes were thin. The battle of the experts would be won by the original three, in his opinion. Wally Bright had on his best suit, which wasn't saying much. He took this criticism with a clenched jaw, bottom lip between his teeth so he wouldn't say something stupid, and he took useless notes on a legal pad because that's what everybody else was doing. It was not his nature to sit back and accept such disparagement, even from a renowned lawyer like Josh Stafford. But he would do anything for the money. The month before, February, his little office generated $2,600 in fees and consumed the usual $4,000 in overhead. Wally took home nothing. Of course, most of his time had been spent on the Phelan matter. Josh skated onto thin ice when he summarized the testimony of their clients. "I've watched the videos of their depositions," he said sadly. "Frankly, with the exception of Mary Ross, I think they will make terrible witnesses at trial." Their lawyers took this in stride. This was a settlement conference, not a trial. He didn't dwell on the heirs. The less said, the better. Their lawyers knew they would get butchered before the jury. "That brings us to Sneed," he said. "I've watched his deposition, too, and frankly, if you call him as a witness at trial, it will be a terrible mistake. In my opinion, in fact, it will border on legal malpractice." Bright, Hark, Langhorne, and Yancey huddled even closer over their legal pads. Sneed was a dirty word among them. They'd fought over who was to blame for botching it so badly. They had lost sleep fretting over the man. They were $500,000 down, and as a witness, he was worthless. "I've known Sneed for almost 20 years, Josh said, then spent 15 minutes effectively portraying him as a butler of marginal talents, a gopher who was not always reliable, a servant Mr. Phelan often talked of firing. They believed every word of it. So much for Sneed.